here. Sorry about that.
That's all right. That's all right. That's all
right. Fucking never mind. I'm going to get it right.
That's all right. All right. Let's see. Am I tall enough? Yeah. Oh, I haven't said anything. What the hell? Who told you to sit in the front row anyway? Bailiff? Anyway. My name is Mike, and I'm an alcoholic. Now, I thought I would keep with the theme of the media, of the convention this weekend, and all the speakers came up and brought their big book. So I didn't want to be left out. So to show them that I'm better than they are, I brought two. I brought the big book and my 12 and 12. You know? Well, it's not my 12 and 12, but... I want to first thank Patrick for calling me to come out and be a part of your group and for all of you that have been involved in this weekend putting this thing together I'm honored to go anywhere that I'm asked to go in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm from the old school. And when I got into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, the people always said this one thing: the hand of AA must always be there, and for that I am responsible. And I believe that is my code by which I choose to live for the last almost 27 years of my sobriety. And I believe that to the innermost of my soul. I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is a way of living. That's what I was told. I was told that I was going to get a rebirth into a new way of life that just might work for me. And all I needed to do was not drink one day at a time and go to meetings. And my sponsor always added this one little extra thing, and excuse the language, work on your shitty attitude and your actions. Please understand, anything that I say from this podium is my own personal experiences. This is my life that I want to talk about and my experience with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Like I said, I believe that this is a way of life for me. I believe that the only thing that will ever remove me from this way of life is if I ever find myself disconnected from the power that I have found a dependency upon that works for me. I'm going to read something in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I always like to read this before I share. And I want to read this because I believe, as one of our speakers was talking this weekend about the cornerstone, that this is the cornerstone of my sobriety. And I believe this to my innermost self. Now, somebody also was talking about the controversies that we try to avoid in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, that we are people who do not get involved in controversies. But we do have one pet controversy. I don't know if you guys celebrate this one up here, but I know down in the L.A. area, it's always been a favorite. And this controversy is over a word. The word is called recovery. Mm-hmm. We have two camps. And I remember when I was getting sober, I used to have a hard time understanding the difference. One camp says that we are recovering alcoholics. And then you have the other camp that says, no, we have recovered alcoholics. And I remember when I was new, I used to see him draw lines in the parking lot and get on either side. And I mean, and they just about getting a duking it out about who was ing-ing and who was ed-ing. And used to confuse the hell out of me. So I went to my sponsor and I said, I don't get this. What's the deal? He said, Mike, first thing we need to do is we need to read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous because it comes from someplace. And he says there is a root word. The root word is called recover. And he says these words, if you look at Webster Dictionary and you pay any attention, ing means present, ed means past. And he says there's a reason for it. He says, "What? But let's read something." And I'm going to, now, for those of you who've seen this book all weekend and don't know what it is, it's called The Big Book. This is a big book. And I'm going to read the foreword to the first edition. And this is the foreword to the first edition as it first appeared in the first printing in 1939. And I'm only going to read the first paragraph. Now, if you haven't read it, you're going to have to get the book to read the rest. It's not very long. What it says here is, "We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. For them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. We think this account of our experience will help everyone to better understand the alcoholic. Many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person. And besides, we are sure that our way of living has its advantages for all." So I looked at my sponsor and I said, "What does that mean?" He says, "Well, let's go back and deal with the word recover." He says, "Let's deal in as it is talked about in Webster. There's two different or three different varieties of the word recover." He says, "In your case, the word recover means that somebody's looking for you because you owe them something and they want to recover it." He says, "But we're not going to go to your lifestyle. We're going to deal with it from the medical term." He says, "From the medical term, the word recover means that something is afflicted. Now, to have an affliction, you have to find out what that may be." He says, "Now, some afflictions could be a broken arm. It could be the eyeball popped out of his socket." You go to the doctor. The doctor looks at you and says, "Boy, you're in bad shape. That arm is definitely broken. And yes, that eyeball is hanging." And he looks at you and he says, "But what we're going to do is we're going to see if we can recover some health in this area. So we're going to put your arm in a cast and we're going to pop that old eyeball back in. Now, during the period that your arm is in the cast and your eyeball has got a patch over it, it is called the recovering period. It means that you cannot use this affliction because you need to let it heal." Now, he says, "Maybe in 30 days, 90 days, however long it takes you to heal when you come back, let me check it out." So you come back to the doctor and he looks and he takes the cast off and says, "The arm looks pretty damn good. The eyeball is staying in socket. It seems to be working, a little crooked, but it's working." And he says, "Guess what? I think you have recovered ED from your injury. Now, if you want, you can go back outside, break your arm again, pop your eyeball out. It's up to you, but I would advise you to easy does it one day at a time." So I said to my sponsor, "I still don't get it." He said, "Well, let's read it one more time, Michael. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered ED from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. What is the affliction, Michael? It is affliction of how I see myself. The word is called seemingly, and it is my identity of hopelessness. It is how I see myself. And if we look the word seemingly up in the Webster Dictionary, it tells us that it's an apparent identity that is not based on anything about fact." Is that the book is telling us, and what it says here, is that I have a way of seeing something that is not based on reality. And that if I don't drink and use one day at a time, I can recover from a way of seeing myself as hopeless. I stand here today. And I know there was one time in my life I knew sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was the most hopeless piece of crap you ever seen. And if I ever forgot, I had lines of people waiting to remind me on a daily basis how hopeless I was. And I stand here today telling you from the top of my head to the bottom of my feet, I am not hopeless. Now, I've been in situations that I thought was hopeless, but I was not the hopeless entity involved. But I am, and I have recovered from this way of seeing myself, but I am a recovering alcoholic from this day forward for one reason only. I cannot take the first drink. And it's not because I'm afraid the first drink is going to get me drunk. It's because I cannot guarantee you that I will not take the second one, the third one, the fourth one, the fifth one, and I promise you I will be drunk. I was born in St. Louis, Missouri. I come from a family of 13 children. My parents didn't have a TV. And I'm the seventh child. My father is half Irish, half Cherokee. If you're confused, my mother was black. My mother's a little bitty woman, and my father's this big, tall guy, and they liked each other a lot. So they had a lot of children. I grew up in a family that was terribly confused. I am a guy who, you know, all my life, I've had three things that were my difficulties before I even found alcohol. Fear. And what surrounded those fears were being different and just downright terrified that you just weren't going to let me be okay. And I was never okay. Now, like I said, I grew up in a home that was terribly confused. My parents couldn't feed us all. So I was brought to California with a younger sister when I was 5 years old from St. Louis, Missouri. She was about 3 years younger than I was. And we were brought to be raised by my grandmother's sister, which is my father's mother. She's full-blooded Cherokee Indian. And we were brought to California to be raised by my great aunt. And she was married to a black man from Birmingham, Alabama. And they were dyed-in-the-wool black, Southern Black Baptists. I grew up in an extremely religious family. My aunt and uncle didn't smoke, they didn't drink, they didn't curse. They believed that if you spare the rod, you spoil the child. We went to church 3 times a week, and that was the reality, and we went to church all day on Sunday. And their attitude is that a hug and a kiss on the cheek was the most affection, and they believed that they, you know, that in the name of God, they beat us. Now, that's the home I grew up in. And I grew up learning from the time I could think, fear, 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 fear. That's all I knew. Now, like I said, we were church-going people. You went to church. My home, we woke up in the morning to Mahalia Jackson. If most of you don't know who that is, she's a black religious singer who's no longer with us. And we went to bed at night to Tex Ritter. Now, my uncle, I don't know where this brother got this, but he loved Tex Ritter. And Tex Ritter, Gene Autry, Hopalong Cassidy. I don't know where this black man grew up, but he loved these people. And that's what we listened to in our home. And we went to church. Now, as a kid growing up, religion was not one of my fun things. I was terrified of our church. Now, if you've never been in a black Baptist church, an authentic, dyed-in-the-wool, orthodox black Baptist church, and I mean there's a difference, because if you know anything about the black Baptists of the South, they are about as orthodox as they get. They dress a certain way, they act a certain way, and that's just the way it is. And when we go to church, it's a hair-raising experience if you're a youngin'. It's terrifying. And I remember as a kid, we'd go to church on Sunday morning, and church was an everyday, all-day thing. You'd get up, and you'd drive an hour to the church, and then you had to go to Sunday school if you were a youngin', and then after Sunday school, everybody go in the church, and they get ready for the preacher who's going to bring the fire and the brimstone, and of course, the choir gets to rocking, and everybody's a-rocking, and all of a sudden, somebody breaks out with the Holy Spirit, and she's about 300 pounds. Now, if you're a 6-year-old, 5-year-old, 8-year-old kid sitting in the pew when she starts busting up everything, it's terrifying. And I tell you, my eyes used to get about yay day. And I told my aunt, I said, I just couldn't believe it. And they had these guys they called the deacons. Now, the deacons were the best-dressed men in the church. I mean, these guys were to the dime, man. And they come in, and they take forever. I mean, it was like eternity. When you're a kid, 3 seconds seems like a light years. And they come walking down this aisle uniformly, and this person's just Holy Spirit all about, just flopping around and tearing up things. And I'd see these guys come down, these big guys, and they grab this poor woman or whoever it was and howl them out and get beat half to death trying to get her out of the pew. So I told my aunt, I said, you know what? As far as I can remember, I said, you could do anything you want. Beat me. I don't care. I'm not going to church. So I got beat a lot, went to church. My aunt decided that, you know, we can't keep killing this kid. You went to church in our home. So she said, we're going to find a church for him. Now, is there any Orthodox Missouri Lutherans in here? Now, if you know anything about them Missouri Lutherans, they just as bad as them Southern Baptists. And I tell you, my aunt, I think she liked this Missouri Lutheran church because they got into the Holy Spirit too, see. And so it was like 5 blocks from our home. And I went to church, this Lutheran. And I was confirmed Lutheran, became an altar boy, sung in the choir, went through catechism, all that. And of course, in the Lutheran church, I learned how to lie and steal. You know, I found, you know, my aunt and uncle were, you know, we were, like I said, I grew up in San Francisco, and they were, for the time, they were what they called upper middle class black people. They were hardworking people. They worked their butts off. And then, like I said, they were very religious. And I grew up in a neighborhood that was predominantly black. I mean, it was black. And, you know, like Charlie, what's his name, had the song called A Boy Named Sue. Well, if you grew up in my neighborhood with my name, you was the boy named Sue. And I mean, I grew up with around the Tyrells and the Jerones. And here I show up, Michael Patrick. And the kids have fun with my name. And my aunt, because my aunt always, Michael Patrick, Michael Patrick. And the kids, of course, I mean, I couldn't get connected to who I was because everybody always teased me. Hey, Michael Patrick. And I was one of these kids that I wasn't one of these rolling around kind of mud kind of kid. So I wasn't a fighter. I was the biggest kid in my neighborhood, and I was the one always getting beat up every day. I mean, the kids would chase me to school. Michael Patrick, roll me around in the mud, take my lunch money. After school, they chase me home and roll me around the mud some more. I get home. My uncle sees me run home, and he's freaking out. He's like, you know, my God, what's wrong with this boy, you know? And his whole idea, I'm going to teach him how to fight. So I get beat up going to school, get beat up coming home, get beat up at home. I mean, it was a mess. Now, I grew up in the early 60s. I grew up when we were flower children, you know, protesting the Vietnam War. And I remember, you know, watching the old TV and listening to the flower children talking about free love. So I decided at the tender age of 13, that I was going to take off from my venture of life, and I ran away from home. Now, that wasn't my first time running away. I had started running away when I was 10 years old. But when I was 13, I got away till I was almost 16 years of age. And I ran off and lived in the streets for almost 3 years or more as a runaway in the Haight-Ashbury. And, of course, I ran off to the Haight-Ashbury looking for the free love. And, of course, I found the free food, the free penicillin, and all that stuff. And ended up growing myself a great big old afro and had all kind of living things in it. And got a great big peace sign and had one of my aunt had gotten me one of these Wild Bill Hickok coats, you know, with the fringes. And I had bells all over it and wore sandals. And I tripped around the Haight-Ashbury having a good time. Now, I want to say this to the people that got here young. You know, I was young when I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know we hear this thing about young people coming in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it talks about us in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know you hear as you're young, oh, the old timers, you know, those 65-year-old guys. And 35-year-old guys are telling you that, I spilled more than you drank. They don't realize we were the ones sitting on the tables with the cup catching it. And, you know. But I want to say this to the young people sitting here in this room. It'll kill you just as quick as it kills them. Alcohol, it kills. Today, it's kind of an irate weekend for me. Two days ago would be a celebration of 1 year that I had to bury someone that was very close to me. She was a young person, and she was like a daughter to me. She grew up around my kids and in my home. Her parents, and I was a single parent for 8 years, When she just latched onto me when she was 14, and her parents, and she was at my home. She was one of mine, and we buried her. And she was one of these people, one of these young people, who the book talks about, and personality characters that we all have as Alcoholics Anonymous. But she was a living, spitting image of this personality, and it's called arrogance, defiance, and belligerence. She was full of it. She was I mean, this girl would fight you to the ends of the earth. She had no idea of what it was that she needed to do. She couldn't surrender. I mean, and bless her heart, she wanted to, but she couldn't. She died from alcoholism and bulimics, being a bulimic. She basically starved herself and drank it away. And I remember seeing her in the hospital, all of her, 5'4", 98 pounds, dying. And me and her parents were standing there watching our baby die. She was 32 years old. And I tell you, I was watching this alcoholic girl lay in this bed and die. And even up to the day she died, she was still belligerent, defiant, and downright in denial of anything. She was arrogant to the end. This program of alcoholism will kill you. So your age has nothing to do with it. Your age has to do with where it takes you and how you get here. That is what is going to maybe save your life and make you stay here. I found myself at the age of, like I said, 16 years of age. 15 years of age, 14 years of age, finding the streets of Haight-Ashbury, where I found my magic potion. My magic potion was Thunderbird wine. Yeah, baby. What's the word? Thunderbird. Ooh. What's that price? Gone, baby. Yeah, they all sit in the back room and be quiet. Jesus, didn't anybody ever tell you show up late? Bless your heart, Tony. Yeah, Thunderbird. That was my elixir, boy. That was the first thing I ever got drunk on was Thunderbird. I was all 13 years old, and I was in the streets, and this wino came up to me. I think it was a wino, I don't know. And he says, "Let's panhandle. You look cold, kid." I didn't know I drank for a reason until I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, but this one worked for me. He said, "You look cold, kid." So we went and panhandled, got us a couple of fifths of T-Bird, went off to Hippie Hill in the 60s and sat up there, and I could still hear the crinkle. You know how that bottle sounds? You know when you twist that top off a T-Bird? Ooh, man. Clickety-clack-clack, clickety-clack-clack. You know? You get that sucker off. You turn it up. You know, when you're a beginner, you don't know. You just, the guy says, "No, man, turn that stuff up, man, turn it up." And you turn it up, and all of a sudden, it hits you, you know? It just gobble, 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 gobble. From the first time I took my first drink, gobble, 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 gobble. And it did exactly what he said it would do. The minute it hit my chest, it was like, whoa. And then it hit my belly. And it would come boom. And my whole world changed. I was warm. I was Harry Belafonte. I was Fred Astaire. I was everything that I never thought I could be. I became. My fear went away. I mean, everything went away. And I drink for that effect. I drink for that effect. I drink for that effect. Every day I thought about it, I think to my last drink, I drank to remember and recapture that first drink. I wanted that kaboom. And yeah, baby, it's on. But I seem to forget something, that my drinking was more for one thing only. I was terrified, I was ashamed, and I was afraid that if you were to see me for who I was not okay. And booze made me okay. I was somebody. I found myself at 16 years of age being arrested for a runaway, and I spent the rest of my life until I was 26 years of age in our institutions. I came into the youth authority at 16. I'd been on the streets for a while, and when I got to the youth authority at 16, my attitude was real simple. You could talk about my mother. You can talk about my father. You can call me all the names you want, but don't you dare touch me. If you touch me, I'm not responsible. So I have some scars, and I left some. I'd hit you as quick as I could see you. That's the way I was. I found myself, at the time I was 18 years of age, being hospitalized for alcoholism. By the time I was 21, I was walking the yard at Vacaville. Now, I didn't plan my life to go that way. I hadn't chose that. I was destined for somewhere, God only knows, I don't know, but it wasn't Vacaville. But for me, it was real simple. I didn't like convicts. I didn't like cops. I was a loner, hadn't had contact with my family for years. And I was basically, like I said, I didn't care if you were animal, female, male, I'd hit you. Bottom line. So they took me into Vacaville. And I was arrested for a series of felonious assaults. Somebody talked about being a bar drinker. I was big guy, so I could go into bars at the age of 18, 19 years old and drink. And I'd tear them up. I'd get drunk, tear them up, get fighting, tear them up, and go to jail. So I found myself at Vacaville. I was only supposed to do 3 years of life. This is in the old days. I got into the prison system in 1976, right before they passed the law of the SB 42 rule in 1977, which took the prison system from a indeterminate sentence to a determinate sentence. And what happened was is that I had just gotten in right after I had been voted in. And so I came in under the old law. I was sentenced under the old law, and I was given a 3-year life, and that meant that they could keep you from 3 years, 1 year, for the rest of my life, depending on how they felt and what I did. And I was one of these guys that didn't program. They said, you know, you program. But like I said, I was a hitter. So, I mean, I would hit you. So I would find myself locked up a lot. They locked me up because I would hit you. And so I found myself, like I said, at Vacaville, and which was the introduction into the northern part of the prison system. At least it used to be. I don't know about what it is now, where it is now. And I was supposed to go to a program called CADAX out at San Quentin. But San Quentin at the time that I got there was locked down. And so they byways me to California Men's Colony in San Luis Obispo. And the CADAX program was for so-called violent prisoners. They would send us to try to modify our behavior. And I was told to go see psychiatrists. I didn't like them. You know, I'd go sit for my 45 minutes and stare at them and piss them off. And the one psychiatrist got so upset with me, he called me an asshole. And said he didn't like me. You know? And I didn't have a problem with that. I had accepted the fact that I was going to live and die in the institutions. I knew how to do time. I knew how to survive. You intimidate, you manipulate, survive. I was given the three rules of institution life. You don't mess with the sissies, you don't gamble, and you don't accept anything from anybody. You survive. If you ain't got it, then you don't need it. If you want it, you better be able to get it on your own. That's how you survive. No problem. So I did my little numbers and kept getting in trouble because I was always getting locked up 30 days here, 40 days here, 60 days here, because I would hit somebody. I was on lockup. I was at the California Men's Colony in San Luis Obispo in 1977, and I was locked up in my cell from another fight. And I had a convict by the name of Bear. And his name was, he was a black convict, and Bear was had been down, he was a lifer. And at the time that I had met him, he had been in locked up for 20 years. And he had 10 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know this at the time, but that's what he had. But he had clout. He had clout amongst the blacks in the joint. So Bear came to my cell one day, and he said to me, he said, Bigum, because that was my nickname in the joint. They called me Bigum. He says, Bigum. He says, there's a call down the hall, a cop down the hall, that asked me to come down and talk to you. He said, for some strange reason, the man thinks there's something here for this institution to save. He says, I want to tell you something about the tough guys, son. He says, Babyface Nelson, Machine Gun Kelly, Al Capone. He said, them boys up in Buddha Hill. He says, you go over there and look out your tin little mirror. He says, you see all the boys walking in the yard, son? They just like you. They waiting to die. He says, but I'll tell you what. He says, every Friday night, we got a AA meeting in the visiting room here at this institution. And he says, you're the lucky guy because the guy right next door to you over here is a sign up for your tier. All you got to do when you come out is put your name on the list. Come to meetings. What do you got to lose? Now, I never tasted coffee till I come to AA. I know nothing about no Alcoholics Anonymous. I was all of 22 years of age. But Bear said it might be a good idea. So I said, what have I got to lose? So I went to the meetings in that institution for almost 3 years. I went to the Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in that institution. Now, between that point, though, I didn't get sober. I wasn't sober. And I was still not a very fun guy to be around. And I want to talk a lot about CMC. Like I said, I was only supposed to be there a little over two years. And because I kept getting what some people talk about, 115s, I stayed almost 6 years. Now, what happened was, is that there's another convict who's dead, and I want to talk about Zach. Bear's gone, too. But Zach was a white convict doing life. He was doing life without the possibility. He was 36 years old. And he came to me one day, and he says, hey, Bigum, you seem to like to fight, man. He says, you ever been in the ring? I said, no, I've never been in the ring. He says every Saturday night, we got fight night. He says, in this institution, they had fight. I mean, they put on rank fights. And he says, why don't you come and work with me? I'll train you, teach you how to box. And I said, sure, what the hell? So he would come and get me. Now, I never got to the ring, but Zach would come and get me, and he was a talker. And he would take me, and we'd run, we'd calisthenic, we'd do this, push-ups, running, talking, shadow boxing, running, talking, and he talked. And what he said to me was these things. He says, Bigum, he says, I'm 36 years old. He said, I committed one crime. I killed somebody. He said, I ain't never getting out of here. He says, I killed them, and I premeditated, killed this person. And I ain't never getting out of here. He says, but you're going to get out of here one of these days. He says, you're 22 years old. What are you going to do, boy? What do you know? He says, you know, there just might be a chance that if you get smart, you won't have to be 36 years old like I am doing what I'm doing. He says, because 90% of us like us live to be 36 continuing to do this. It's usually too late. He says, but there's hope for you. He says, you know, there's a trade in this institution. He says, there's only two places in the whole world you can learn this trade. One is in the Navy, and the other one is right here. And he says, that trade is called water treatment, working with steam generators. He says, now it's not going to pay you big money. He said, but it'll pay you a hell of a better living than what you've been doing. He says, if you think about it and you want to try it, he says, I'll, you know, help you and we'll pull some strings and we'll get you out there to the steam plant. Now, those of you who have done time know that the convicts, we kind of run everything. So I found myself listening to Zach. My problem was, is I said, Zach, I can't read. Now, I could read a little bit, but I couldn't read. So Zach says, well, we fixed that problem. We'll teach you how to read, son. So he went and got me the first book I ever learned to read, and it was called Tolstoy's War and Peace. Now, he brought me the unabridged version of Tolstoy's War and Peace. Now, when you can't read, that book is yay big. And he said to me these words, Bingham, you got a problem? Come see me. We'll work it out. Now, if you know anything about Tolstoy's War and Peace, the minute you open the book and you can't read, you got a problem. And I went to him and said, I got a problem. And he introduced me to Webster. And he said, if you have a problem with that, just let me know. Now, he was smarter than the average bear, because he figured a young whoopersnapper like me would think that an old nuthead like him ain't never read the book. So I would always try to think I razzle and dazzle him about reading the book. And he would say, where in the hell is that in the book? So I learned to read. Eventually they pulled some strings and they got me my job and they got me out and they separated us. And in the later part of 1977, 78, I was going to the meetings, still drinking, because we got good booze and drugs in the penitentiary. Man, we make some of the best house pruno. Yeah, hey, babe, you know, don't you, brother? Yeah, I see you out there. I see him shaking his head. Yeah, man, you get them oranges, and you get that little apple, and you get some, and if you got get your partners, you know, because you got to work it, you know, you got to work this thing, because you got to have some yeast now, and you got to have one guy bringing the yeast in from the bakery, and you got to have one guy bringing the sugar in from the kitchen, and everybody sharing, and they sneak their little oranges in, and their little whatever, you know. Sometimes we might want to spread it up a little bit, put some grapes in there, don't we? Yeah, and some put some bananas in there, you know, just to give it a little twist, and we let it cook. Lord have mercy, I've seen people just do flips. I mean, take that first sip and they be flipping. Yeah. What's wrong with that brother? Man, he gonna get us busted. I mean, that's some good drink. So I was drinking and doing drugs and going to meetings and shadow boxing, and he got me my job. And they separated us. That was in 1978. Never saw Zach again until 1992. CMC, California Men's Colony in San Luis Obispo. You had a warden up here talking yesterday, and I don't mean to bust his bubble, but he don't know much about institution AA, because the oldest and largest prison group in the world is the California Men's Colony in San Luis Obispo. It is the oldest established actual AA group in the world. We have been an established group since 1978. Now, I was one of the original members that helped form that group in 1978. We became what we call the Big Four Fellowship. We were registered in the New York Big World Book as the Big Four Fellowship in 1978. We were 50 members. That group is now 300 members strong. And it is the largest actual running AA group that is run by prisoners. Every Friday night, we got to speak. We got an inmate outside speaker meeting. It's a two-hour meeting. And I tell you, it's the best AA meeting you'll ever go to. These boys put on a hell of a meeting. And 90% of those guys are lifers. They are lifers. And they are one hell of a group. Another thing about CMC, in the last year, they have paroled more lifers from CMC than any prison in the state of California. They have paroled 8 lifers who have paroled with as much as 17 to 27 years in the last year. And they all were members of the Big Four Fellowship. And they all have been members of the Big Four Fellowship. The youngest guy was 10 years. and the rest of them had 20 years, 20, 15 years of sobriety in the Big Four Fellowship. That's my home group. Those are my boys. I've been taking panels into that prison penitentiary for the last 24 years. And that you want to talk about a prison that works with Alcoholics Anonymous? We've had three wardens, and they've turned flips in helping us run and get our meetings in that prison. It is the only prison with my kind of background that I can go into. All the rest of them say I'm undesirable. But CMC, for the last 24 years, any time, any day, I walk in and I walk out. They love to see us coming. They love to see us coming. And it's the only one that I know of that works with us. We have a hell of a program up there. We have the institution, which we have what we call our inside sponsor. And I want to talk about this one lady. Her name is Kathy Bethel. I met Kathy Bethel when I was 22 years old, and she was just an intern, a CD1. Kathy was 27 years old, and she had just come out of college, and she was in her first year of working at the California Men's Colony in 1976. And what had happened was they were a small AA, just a bunch of guys that got together, and they had one guy from the street that used to come in, and his name was Art Mayhew. And Art Mayhew was from Ventura. And Art Mayhew used to come into that institution since he started bringing a few of his guys in 1972. They had a little group, 20 guys, 5 guys, 10 guys, whatever. Art came in. Well, in 1976, the guy, Art, died. He gave it over to another person who I call my dad. His name is Ben Elliott. And Art turned it over to Ben Elliott in 1976. And he's my dad. He's my adopted dad. In my sobriety. And then, along with Kathy, started trying to put together an AA group. And what happened was that the institution said, you need bylaws. We're not going to let this group exist any longer if you do not have bylaws. So, we had a few convicts in there that knew the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous in the 12th edition. We got the book on world services and what the services codes were. And for 2 years, by the grace of God, I don't know why, none of us didn't kill one of each other, but you had 8 egomaniac convicts trying to put together an AA group that would suit the penitentiary and be in line with the principles and the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, we fought. I mean, Jesus. Now, I was the coffee man. Now, and the guys used to have problems with me being the coffee man because I was, like I said, I was not a friendly guy. And, I mean, I was really cheap with the sugar. And the guys used to just get upset with me because they were like, this is our meat. Why are you hogging the sugar? I mean, I was like, you know, they'd come up and I'd give them one lump. And they're like, well, where's the second lump? Move on. You know? So they would just get pissed off. They're like, I mean, I just riots, and they slip notes under my door. Don't show up to the meeting, you know? So Kathy Bethel figured this is what she would do. She would solve the problem. So what she did was she made me the sergeant of arms of the group. So I became the sergeant of arms of the Big Four Fellowship before we were the Big Four Fellowship, and we would meet, and we would fight, and we would argue, and Ben would come in from the streets. The prison allowed him to come in, and we sat, and we worked, and we worked, and we came up with a steering committee, bylaws. That group has a GSR. They have a secretary. They have I'm a treasurer. They buy their own coffees. They all chip in every once a year. They throw a big social for their outside people that's come in, and they put on one hell of a feast for us. And we go for 2 hours every Friday, and I tell you, it's a meeting that you ain't never been to. And what we do is these guys, it's their meeting. We are the guests. We are the visitors. And they go in, we go in, and we all sit in this room with them. And the group is so big that they can't have 300 convicts in the room at one time. So what they do is they divide them up into two groups. You have A group, B group. You can only have 50 inmates. They had to have one free person or guard for every 50 inmates. And these were free people, not guards. The guards never come into our meeting. So these guys are free to talk about whatever the hell they want to talk about. It's not being taped. They're not worrying about a damn thing. And I tell you, it is, I'm telling you, to see these guys come in and see them walk. I mean, I've sat in that room for the last 20-something years and watched guys. I used to sit all the way in the back and watch them slowly move to the front. Slowly move to the front. And eventually they come up here and they said, I'm an alcoholic. Eight lifers, and they're all AA members. I'm in contact with all of them. And you know what they did when they got out? Ring-a-ring-a-ring-a-ring-a-ring-a. They go to meetings. The oldest guy to get out, his name is Eugene, and Eugene got out after 27 years sobriety of a March of last year. And Eugene has been a part of my life for 20-something years. I watched this man who came in. He was a Black Gorilla family member come in from San Quentin, go through the whatever the magic that works in Alcoholics Anonymous. And watching him sit in the room and be in the same room with him and his mother and have her sit there just smiling ear to ear. And watching him sit there and we just look at each other and we just, tears just welp up and we just say, man, oh man, oh man. That's the gift. I started, like I said, going to the meetings in 1977, 78. And I wasn't a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I just was one of those guys who go on because they said you get a piece of paper that says you program and they give you a date. But they had passed the SB 42 rule. And so in the later part of 1978, I got the chrono that said as of 1980, every person that was in a so-called lifer or in the penitentiary had to be on this new SB 42 rule. So I've gotten a date, February 2nd. I said to myself, that's nice. I remember sitting in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I used to watch you people come in on the panels. You come in on the panels, and you talk about your new way of life. And you talk about the spiritual thing that has happened. And you see, I was the wrong guy to hear that because I come from a religious background. It's just turned me off. I'm off. But I heard one thing you always said when you came in those meetings, and I knew you were talking to me. Because what you said was, if you like what you got, keep it. If you feel good about yourself every day when you get up in the morning and you like what you see that looks back at you in your tin mirror, keep it. And if you get excited about how you're going to spend your day and who you're going to spend your day with and all the roof and come on, I don't, man, just to knock yourself out. You just hang right on to it. And when you get finished with your day and you come back to your cell and you like how it sounds when they clang that thing shut and you had such a serene, beautiful day and you crawl up in your bunk and you're at ease and peace and you knock yourself out. You hang right on to it. But if you ever find yourself any day looking in that mirror in your cell and looking at something that gives you no reprieve, then Alcoholics Anonymous might work for you. It works for me. That's what I heard. And I kept going to the meetings and kept going to the meetings. Ben and I made a connection. And we made a connection one time about 1979. I used to hear people come in, and I would never talk to the people. I didn't want to tell convicts to go talk to you guys. I didn't want to talk to none of you. Kathy used to try to get me to go up there and talk, because I always ask her about Ben. You know, he's such a religious friend, you know. And she'd say, why don't you go talk to him? I want to also talk about another lady. Her name is Barbara St. Johns. Barbara St. Johns was the first person to ever really get to me. And she got to me because she was Kathy Bethel. And she's retired now, so she don't have to worry about this. But Barbara used to give books, and she came in on the panel with her husband. She was an alcoholic. She was an Al-Anon. And she came on one of the socials in 1979. And right after we'd got our group formed, we had our first big social. And she came in. And she just latched on to me. And I had a problem with Barbara. I don't know why, but I had a problem with this white woman. I don't know what it was. But I didn't like her. Didn't like her at all. And she used to sneak books. She couldn't write to me. So she would have Ben and her husband, Mac, bring books up to give to Kathy to give to me. First book I got from her was called Living Sober. Yeah. And she would go through and the highlight things she wanted me to read. And her favorite one was love, the one on love, and the one on if. Remember the one in there talks about the if factor. And she highlighted this stuff, right? And then she got me the little red book and stools, bottles and stools. And she highlighted. And she'd give them to Kathy. And Kathy would tell me to come to her office, and she'd give me these books. And I would just like, and Barbara White would write these little things, and hope your day's doing well, and all this weird stuff, you know, and used to just piss me off. And I'm like, and I went to her, and I said, I don't want this stuff. I mean, who is this woman? Why is she giving? Why are you giving? I don't want anything from this woman. And she said, I don't care what you do to it. You take it, burn it, do whatever you want, but this is for you. Take it. Barbara St. John's. Barbara St. John's, because my life is based on relationships. My sobriety is based on relationships. I'm here today with the amount of time that I have and living the quality life that I live. Sometimes I don't think it's very quality, but I get a little confused. But I want to tell you something. My life is based on relationships and some very special relationships. And I'm a people pleaser today. And I live for these people. And Barbara St. John, she's no longer with us, but she was one of these people. Barbara St. John grew up in a family down She grew up in a Jewish community down near in L.A. Where they had the big riot. Watts, thank you. And her family owned some of the tenants that the blacks lived in. And she was there during the Watts riots. And her father, her grandfather and father, were devout Klansmen. Barbara St. John's, had never, ever really talked to a black person in all her life. She worked at a bookstore in Thousand Oaks, and if black people came into the bookstore, she wouldn't wait on them. Somebody else would wait on them. And we connected. I don't know why, but we connected. I'm the first black person when I got out that ever was in her home. And we loved each other dearly. And she healed me, and I healed her. And she died. And I didn't find any of this out until after she died. And Mac was, and we were driving down to, Mac and I were driving down to set up everything for her funeral. And he's telling me about Barbara. She didn't want me to know. She said, she didn't want you to know, but I felt you needed to know who she was and what you meant to her. Then, like I said, there's another one of these Eskimos in my life. And I had a problem. And I didn't understand your philosophy. But Kathy said to me, Miss Bethel, they come in here not for you, Michael. They come in here to stay sober one day at a time. This is what they do to make sure that they don't end up here with you. And I said, oh. So I decided to go talk to Ben, because Ben was into the God thing, and I had a problem with God. And we have been tight and thick as thieves ever since that meeting of him and I sitting in that prison meeting. He was the first free person in the 2 years I had gone to the meetings that I ever talked to. And him and I sat on the back table at that meeting, and we talked. And I don't know what happened in that meeting. I just know that Ben and I talked. And his family adopted me, and his wife to me. I mean, she's my mom, and I'm her. I mean, that's just his son, his daughter. I mean, his grandchildren. I mean, we're just my children. We're family. They came when they decided to let me out of this institution, and I came to the streets of Alcoholics Anonymous with what I knew, which was nothing. I wasn't sober. I didn't get sober until 1979, November. And I got sober because another convict came down to my cell, and he was disappointed in me. You see, I have always had two things that I couldn't. It either most of the time I ran from it and I hid from it. It's called the badge of shame. And one of my problems with the institution people today is that they seem to talk about wanting us to help us be different and rehabilitate us, but they still refuse to allow us to escape the badge of shame. It's funny how they live in that two-double world, but they do. I see it all the time. And I've been doing it a long time. They don't let us get away from the badge of shame. They want us to come in, but then they say, oh, no. And we're the people that coming in that they most of these people need to see, but they don't want us in. It's funny. But yet they say they do. Scary. But anyway, I left this institution and I came to the streets of Alcoholics Anonymous with what I knew. Nothing. And I ran around the streets of Alcoholics Anonymous full of everything. I had a whole head of AA and no knowledge of anything. And I was nuts. I ran around the rooms of AA doing everything. They said not to do it. I did it 300 times over. They said don't 13-step. I 15, 16, 18-step. And I had this sponsor who was so cool. He used to sit and look at me and said, crap head. Go to meetings, work on your shitty attitudes and your actions, and don't drink in between. He was from the old school. And he said to me, crap head, I want you to, for the first 60, 90 days, 1 year, he says, for you, maybe 3 years, sit down, shut up, and listen. I don't want you sharing from a podium. If you want to share, when we get one-on-one, we'll share. He says, I want you to remember one thing always. I'm sensitive. And I'm like, sensitive? He says, yeah. He says, I'm sensitive because I don't want to be sitting in the room with one of my buddies and having crap head up here talking from the podium. And Buddy nudging me said, do you sponsor that guy? He said, I'm sensitive. So he said, don't drink, go to meetings, work on your shitty attitudes and your actions, and your life just may get better. We have, someone talked this weekend about the gift of integrity. We buried a friend of ours, Dale Davenport. And Dale died. Dale was an old Texas boy, and him and I were tight as thieves. And Dale was a special guy. He died 1 week, I think, before his 32nd birthday. And I was at Dale's hospital the week before he died, and we're sitting on the bed, and we're crying together, and we're hugging each other. And he talked with that old Texas drawl, you know. And he's hugging me, and he's saying, Michael Patrick, where in the hell could you go, an alcoholic in this world, anywhere, and have an old redneck like me and an old black street boy like you sitting in the hospital crying and hugging each other, talking about the magic potion called love? Where could you go but Alcoholics Anonymous? He says, I want you to tell you something, and I want you to remember this as long as you live, that there's one gift that is given to you in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you need to recognize it, and you need to polish it, and you must make it the most important shield that you'll ever walk through the rooms in life with. And he says it's called integrity. He says, I don't care where you go, what you do, you make damn sure it's polished well. You make sure that no matter what battle you go into, even if you lose, you walk out with its integrity intact. And you remember that always. I don't care what else you remember that. You know, we hear a lot of things in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. For me, it has nothing to do with AA. AA, I was told, is about love and service. I was told that it was about this triangle called the legacy of Alcoholics Anonymous, which on the bottom says recovery and unity and services on the other side. And what it says there is that service is what's bridged us together as a unity, as a group, as people coming together. And what we do is we bring the hope of recovery to a whole lot of people, not just to ourselves. And that's our legacy, that we're responsible for that. And it's based on love and tolerance and love and service. That's what I was told. I also hear this crazy stuff about, I don't know how we take the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we've allowed people over the years, I mean, Harold was talking about it last night, how we've allowed people over the years to take a positive program that's based on principle of life, that's supposed to take us from the gates of hell and bring us to a way of life that has surpassed anything we've never thought possible. And that we could be a part of society, be a part of our fellow men, and be joyous and free. My version of God's will for me is, as Bob was speaking about, and what he said, it came out of the big book. And what it says in the big book, and I think it's somewhere, happens to do with, we won't go there. You have to read it. But I think it says there, we would like to believe that God's will for us is to be happy, joyous, and free. It doesn't say anywhere in the book that we know what God's will is. And it doesn't say anywhere in the book that we're supposed to know what God's will is. It says we hope, we would like to believe that that is what His will is for me on a daily basis. And that I'm responsible for one thing, me. I'm responsible on a daily basis that the 12 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and my principle and my way of life is what the new person sees. And I pray to God that it's an example of who you are on a daily basis, because that's what you gave me. I believe that the first step is about finding a humbleness and finding humility in our lives through being willing, more than anything else, to find acceptance of the fact that I am powerless over people, places, and things. And I need to accept it to my innermost self. I had to turn the word admit into accept for me. Because I'll admit to anything if it's going to get me out of something. But accept it, that's a whole nother ball game. I ain't accepting an ass whooping. But that's what it says for me. And that the first realm of humility is accepting the fact that I'm powerless. I've taken up too much time here, and I'm going to stop. I've found a way of life that works for Michael Patrick Hogan. It works like it's never worked before. And I'm so proud of you, because it's you who gave me this life. All you said to me is, Michael, be the best guy today that you can be. Try not to allow your actions to hurt another human being and indirectly hurt yourself. And you give your life to God, and you go about your business, and you do the best that you can one day at a time. I want to say this one thing, and I want to read something. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about the herd effect. It's in the book. It says herd effect. I'm not going to tell you where it's at. You got to read it. And I hear people going around the rooms talking about, get in the center of the herd. Stay in the center of the herd. Don't let yourself get cut to the outside. They'll kill you off. No. That's not what the herd effect, as described in the book, is about. The herd effect, as is described in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, is based on an actual theory. It happens to do with animals. And these animals, certain times, they like to herd together. Now, they herd together for a purpose. It's called not only survival, but it calls being able to identify. And they herd together for this reason. The people they keep, the animals that they keep in the center are the young and the inexperienced. And they keep them in the center so that while they're in the center, they're protected so they can learn and learn how to live and survive on the outside. And as they get more knowledgeable and more comfortable, the old timers move over and let them move on to the outside. And the ones on the outside are usually the wise ones. They're watching everything that's going on. They let the herd know when there's a big pack of wolves coming down the road. And the ones that are sick and are too old to get away, they don't wander there. They just basically stay because they can't keep up with the herd. But the herd moves to survive. And what happens is that these if you're an antelope and you're in the center of a herd of hippopotamus, you're in trouble if you can't swim. So you better be extremely careful about what herd you get in the center of. The herd effect, as it speaks about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, talks about identity. It talks about identifying, that we come together. And the herd effect works because we identify with the likeness. And the likeness we identify is, as Bob talked about, misery. It loves company. Shame, pain, anger, rage, frustration, lack of, more want. In the 12 and 12, there's a chapter called the step 12. I'm only going to read a little bit. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. The joy of living is the theme of AA's 12 step. And action is the key word. Here we turn outward toward our fellow alcoholics who are still in distress. Here we experience the kind of giving that asks no rewards. Here we begin to practice all 12 steps of the program in our daily living, in our daily lives, so that we and those about us may find emotional sobriety. I remember I said to my sponsor, "What is that?" He said, "Don't worry, you ain't got it." Keep coming back. Keep coming back, Mike. It will happen one day at a time. When the 12th step is seen in its full implication, it is really talking about the kind of love that has no price tag on it. Our 12 steps also says that as a result of practicing all these steps, we have each found something called a spiritual awakening. To the new people sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, awakening means to be aware. So the only way one becomes aware is something has to happen to waken them up. And it's usually called an experience. So you cannot have an awakening until you've had an experience. And the awakening is the awareness and the result of a spiritual experience. To new AAs, this often seems like a very dubious and improbable state of affair. What do you mean when you talk about a spiritual awakening, they ask? Maybe there are as many different definitions of a spiritual awakening as there are people who have had them. But certainly, each genuine one has something in common with all the others. And these things which they have in common are not hard to understand. When a man or a woman has had a spiritual awakening, the most important meaning of it is that he has now become able to do, feel, and believe that which he could not do before on his own unaided strength and resources alone. Here he has been granted a gift. Our sobriety and our lives are gifts. They're gifts. You can reject it or you can keep it. You can take it back down to the general store and say, I don't like this. I won't exchange it. Which amounts to a new state of consciousness of being. He has been set on a path which tells him he is really going somewhere. That life is not a dead end, not something to be endured or mastered. It is in a very real sense, he has been transformed because he has laid hold of a source of strength, which in one way or another has that he has denied himself. He finds himself in possession of a degree of honesty, tolerance, unselfishness, peace of mind, which is all I ever wanted, and that's what the 11th step gave me. It gave me peace of mind. And it says it there. It says we find peace of mind through the practice of prayer and meditation. And from this, we are given a gift called emotional sobriety. Read the 11th step. And love, of which he has thought himself quite incapable. What he has received is a free gift, and yet usually, at least in some small part, he has made himself ready to receive it. From the bottom of my heart, I want to thank every one of you sitting in this room, all of you that ain't here, that have been a part of this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, that's been a spiritual experience in my life, that has given me something I never thought possible. What I do for a living today is I'm an engineer in a power plant for the city of Glendale and a steam generator. I work in Glendale Electrical Generating Plant, and I've worked for them for 24 years, and they think I know something. I don't know where they get it from. But I was the first convict of my kind that they hired. They sent me to school for 6 years, and they trained me. And today I like to say I'm one of the best employees that they think they might have. But I want to tell you this one thing about the power plant, and I'm going to sit down. We read in the book all the time about power is our lack of dilemma. I have business cards, and my business card says, Michael Patrick Hogan, power plant control operator. Now, you know, we stay away from control, and we stay away from power, and now Alcoholics Anonymous. But that's what my title says. There are times when I'm sitting in this big major control room, and I'm the second kahuna behind my boss, and I'm making decisions for 40 guys. And making sure the power of the Glendale and wherever it's going is being taken care of. And there are times that we have in the power plant, we have these things called red buttons. They're two little red buttons. And these red buttons are great. Because what you can do is that if you hit these two red buttons, you'd black out Glendale. Yeah, baby. Now, I'm talking about the ultimate control of power. And I'm sitting there at times when I'm at work and I'm thinking. And I'm pacing. And I'm looking at them red buttons. And of course, my boss, he tapped me on the shoulder and said, it's not a good idea today, Michael. It's not a good idea today. If you're new here in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, there is a solution. And the solution is based upon spiritual principles and the willingness to give back what has been so freely given to you. And I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for opening up yours and coming into the institution and bringing your life and your brand of love that has bathed me more and more times than I can think of. And I'm forever grateful. Thank you.